let me start out the panel discussion by referring to two things that Mark was just talking about. One is the dissociation of the growth in productivity, in other words, the value that a worker can create in 1 hour's work and wages that starts in the late 1970s. And the second thing is what? I guess just the what all of our panelists have been talking about is the accelerating inequality between especially the 0.1% at the very top and the rest of the working class, and especially those at the very bottom of the working class. I used to do a PowerPoint in the late 90s or early 2000s talking about a lot of these same issues, and including the growth in CEO pay and so forth. And even back then, it was very, very stark, very startling. And would use that slide showing how from the end of the Second World War until the end of the 1970s, productivity went up and workers' wages went up about the same rate. So in other words, workers were getting their fair share of the increased value that they created in 1 hour's work. And my pitch was always, you know, this is what we have to turn around. And it was Bill Fletcher, who is one of the people that I respect most in the labor movement. We were on a panel together about a year ago, and he was saying, you know, I used to say the same sort of thing, but I've come to realize that that period between the end of the Second World War and the late 1970s is not normality. That is a very abnormal period. It was a period in which we created the American middle class, but it is the it's not what we should expect to be the normal course of things. And the primary reason that we had that greater equality building after the Second World War was basically the labor movement.
Yes, yep.
And unions had enough power to be able to demand their fair share of increased wealth. And that power had declined enough by the late 1970s that we get to the class war that Warren Buffett was talking about, which was the other thing that I had forgotten, saying that, yes, there's a class war going on, and class, meaning the ultra-rich, is winning.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't mean to talk for so long, but just throw that out as a possible reformulation of how we think about the predicament we're in, and at the end of our program, where do we go from here to turn that around?
One thing, David, which I think that sort of relates to, you know, part of the topic for tonight's discussion is America's race to the bottom. And putting that in its darkest terms, it really becomes clear how far we have fallen, because of the 21 wealthiest nations in the world, we are currently at or near the bottom in almost all the things that really matter in terms of longevity, infant mortality, in terms of daycare for working families. There are so many things that are really critical to our way, our quality of life, whereas the richest nation in the world, we are bringing up the rear. And this wasn't always the case, and it's really happened or been accelerated rapidly in the last couple decades. And if we want to turn it around, we have got our work cut out for us.
One of the things that I wonder about, and I don't know if I haven't seen any research on this, I don't know, maybe you have, Laura, is whether that opening of the wedge between productivity and wages is an international phenomenon, whether it's the case everywhere or whether it's the case everywhere but not as wide, you know, as here. I mean, we know that inequality is greater here. We know that that's gone up faster. But I haven't seen any studies relating the productivity issue to that. And so that seems to me, let me hypothesize that the wedge isn't as wide in some of these places, especially places where inequality isn't as great. Mm-hmm. That leads us sort of in the direction of saying what seems to be working better in those places. I mean, labor is probably stronger in some places, but it's certainly under attack, you know, in a lot of places around the world. Globalization is certainly exerting downward pressures kind of everywhere, but yet, I think it was one of you mentioned Germany, I think, or maybe did. You know, they've certainly taken a different approach, you know, with regard to manufacturing. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, looking at things, you know, comparatively, is obviously an important factor. And I guess the other issue relating to what you just said, Charlie, is about the politics of all this. You talk about the U.S. ranking so low in all these indicators. What's the disconnect between that reality and general recognition in the electorate, for example, of that, and saying, you know, enough's enough. We need to do something about this. In the same way that there's the disconnect between what people understand to be the level of inequality in the country and what the level really is. So how do we get through kind of those filters that are kind of in some ways impeding mobilization around those issues? I think that's a real big question to talk about.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure I've seen I know the inequality stuff works the way you say, which is that inequality is increasing across the globe. It is not increasing at anywhere near the rate, especially the 2000 increases. The increases in inequality we've had since the turn of the century are uniquely dramatic. Inequality has increased everywhere. Everywhere. In the developed world, I think, you know, you see this increase. And I think I've seen the productivity version of the wedge as well, but I'm not positive now. But I think it's exactly right to point out the way that institutions hold that those lines together. You know, maybe Bill Fletcher's right, like that was exceptional, or maybe it's just only possible in the context of having institutions that are intended to hold those lines together. But whether that is, you know, essentially Denmark, for example, doesn't have a minimum wage, but every wage is negotiated. And so they have an effective floor through union contract negotiation that is at just 2/3 the median wage. And hotel workers, who I happen to know, a little bit about hotel workers in Denmark. God, why? And so, you know, they're the happiest hotel workers on the planet because they're so close to the median. But that's not done through public policy in the sense that it's a minimum wage. It's done through a public compact, public structures that essentially tie that negotiation with the productivity line. And the most obvious place this happens is in Germany. The metal workers, the automakers, you know, see what's going on with productivity, make a contract deal, and that contract deal covers all the auto workers in the country, whether you're a member union or not. That contract covers German automaking. And then that increase trickles all the way down through every contract, which is how, again, Germany doesn't have a minimum wage. It has a bunch of negotiated wages. But again, it has a much higher floor. Now, it is true that in Germany, you have this big guest worker and temp agency problem around the hotels. So it isn't that, you know, Germany's perfect. But in Europe, you tend to have all these institutions that tie those things together. In the U.S., I think we only had unions tying productivity increases to wage increases. We don't have social compacts. We don't have extension of bargaining rights. We don't, or coverage of contracts. We don't have social partners, right? Like all of Europe runs on this kind of social partner model where everybody has to agree to stuff. You know, here, business makes a rule and
take it or leave it.
You take it or leave it, right? There they go. So I think that's a, you know, excellent point and sort of indicates where some of the options are. Is Europe doomed?
I don't think they're. I think they're doomed.
You think they're doomed because the downward pressure of globalization is so enormous that they can't hold it?
Can't learn anything from it.
You know.
Why are they doomed? I'm not following.
Because capitalism drives everything to the bottom. The whole point of your presentation here. You have a few islands of exceptions. You see exceptions, but I think David's right. They are exceptions to the trend of evolution of capitalism.
Well,
I think that occurs in the absence of any organized countervailing force, such as labor unions. One of the things that's unique, somewhat unique about labor unions in Germany is that they are involved much more than here in a sort of a partnership with businesses. Members of the union are actually on the board of directors of most of the German companies. So they can see the books, and when it comes time for negotiations, there's really a way of, you know, coming up with something that really represents a more equitable share or distribution of resources. One of the things that was sort of touched on, and to put it in terms of some numbers, about the gap between increased productivity and wages, the minimum wage today, if it had kept up with the increased rate of productivity, minimum wage would be over $21 an hour. The average wage would be over $41 an hour if wages had kept up with productivity. So how did we get from where we were in the late 70s to where we are now? You know, there's the old adage, you can steal more with a pen than you can with a gun. In many respects, I think what's happened represents a theft.
I mean, I would just add a case can certainly be made that we're all doomed. I mean, that in fact this is the right. Well, that in fact the pressures of contemporary capitalism exert the forces that in fact they exert, and that is obviously, you know, resulting in the race to the bottom. But it seems to me that taking a broader, longer, and hopefully slightly more optimistic historical perspective on this, that
capitalism is doomed.
Capitalism is doomed. Well, okay. I thought you were saying the countries are doomed.
Yeah. And
that, you know, when we establish, you know, different kinds of institutional arrangements, you know, Laura mentions the happy hotel workers in Denmark. They're pretty happy in Las Vegas, too. Right? I mean, and that's in a very capitalist U.S., where hotel workers in Las Vegas are paid, well, of course, almost everyone in Las Vegas is a hotel worker, but they, you know, they make the median wage. You've got, obviously, you know, a strong union there. And I think, you know, basically, when you have those institutional arrangements nurtured. So, you know, I think there are reasons for clear pessimism. We may have reached a stage of capitalist development where things are going to be pushing in, you know, really even worse directions, or we may reach a point where mobilization obviously becomes possible and then some of these new institutional arrangements can, in fact, be established. I prefer to take the more positive.
One thing that might help put things in perspective a little bit, you turn the last century in Milwaukee. Milwaukee was characterized by rampant corruption and cronyism and a lot of real problems. Interesting thing, in 1936, Dan Hoehn, who was socialist mayor of Milwaukee for 24 years, was on the cover of Time magazine, hailed as perhaps the ablest public servant in the country. And the kind of turnaround that took place was really remarkable. Milwaukee at the time, believe it or not, was considered perhaps the best-run city in the country in terms of the quality of public services, parks and schools, in terms of the basic services, garbage pickup. That's why sometimes the Milwaukee socialists were sometimes referred to as sewer socialists, because there was a lot of emphasis on providing people with basic services. I think that should be some basis for a little bit of optimism in the sense that things can be turned around, but it's going to take an enormous effort, and it's going to take a tremendous effort in terms of people informing themselves about what's going on, speaking out and speaking to their neighbors and their friends and their coworkers, and beginning to organize the kind of countervailing pressure that's going to be necessary to change the policies which have tilted the table so dramatically in the favor of the very wealthy.
Okay, let's open this up to the rest of the audience, and Joe will take the microphone to the chosen few.
Hi. I'm not a professor. I'm not a big shot, but this is an issue I've given
lucky you
enormous thought in the last few years. I've thought of this, the issue of employment in particular, but a lot of other things, in the context of, okay, what stories are we telling ourselves about what causes the things to go wrong that we don't like, and what stories aren't we telling ourselves? And I would suggest, or my one thing that I have come to believe is that many of the stories we progressives tell ourselves and tell everyone who will listen aren't working. About what is cause and what is effect. And I want to throw out a very different way of looking at unemployment that I don't hear anybody talking about. How many of you heard of the term emergence? Okay, the idea with emergence in a mathematical sense is you have entities that keep repeating the same thing again and again, and something emerges from it. Fractals are an example of that. I have thought in the context of unemployment, I can think of ways that unemployment has happened the way it has, and income disparity has occurred the way it has, because several hundred million of us in this country have repeated certain behaviors again and again, which in the aggregate drive out every economic entity out there, every business entity out there, which fails to slash labor costs as much as possible and reward the handful of people who are most successful at slashing. When I think of Walmart, I would guess that if you stop paying Walmart shareholders anything and stop paying the Walton family anything and took that off the prices of their goods and services, it would hardly make a dent. So if I look at things that way, I've got to look at that several hundred million people at what we're doing and the effects of what we're doing, intended or not. And the thing that strikes me is that one story that is utterly useless to tell ourselves is that there is any other factor on earth that sustains employment other than our will collectively to support one another. In other words, the story that there's a thing out there called the economy, that when it grows, jobs come rattling out, is useless. The story that, well, the economy, if it's growing, jobs will come rattling out, but sometimes it doesn't grow, so the government has to goose it, and we have to have unions to protect workers. It's not working.
Comments?
There are a couple examples that I think are a little bit counter to that. For example, Costco, which is a capitalist firm, but which has, as a matter of policy, set a cap on their CEO compensation as a percentage of the lowest paid worker, where the fringe benefits and the kind of income that workers have there is actually a living wage, and yet they have been extremely competitive and very effective in holding their own in terms of market share.
Against Walmart,
yes. I think one of the things that is sort of interesting, there is a book called What Matters Most, written by the CEO of, I think, a corporation called Seventh Generation. They make cleaning products and things like that. But the book basically holds the premise that historically, long term, the companies that do the best are the companies that pay their employees well, that treat their employees well, that don't pollute the environment and have a lot of turnover and legal costs and other kinds of things that represent an additional burden in terms of cost of doing business. So I think there is, even within the constraints of a capitalist economy, there are some examples of ways in which some of the negative things, impacts, can be minimized. I think what it really requires is a longer-term commitment in terms of looking at long-term. One of the things my dad used to say, which I was fond of, sort of, he said, if you want to hang a capitalist, he'll sell you the rope. And I think in many respects that reflects a large part of the dilemma, that too much of the focus is on the short term. If somebody can make a quick buck by slashing wages or cutting back or cutting corners, there's a lot of incentive in the short term to do that. In the long term, that's not very good business sense.
I don't hear you addressing at all consumers.
Well, consumers...
The focus is the lowest price, and who really doesn't want to know about all the externalities? It really does not make an effort to know about it.
You're absolutely right.
That's in this country, that's 300 million people. You run that equation more often than you run the equations of consumers saying, hey, I want to support my local farmers.
Yep.
I think you get what you have. What we have.
Well, one of the things that's at present the sort of the gorilla in the room, a 900-pound gorilla in the room, is that 80% of our economy is basically driven by consumer purchases. One of the things that pushed us more and more into the recession is that those consumers have had less and less to spend. But we can't necessarily spend our way out of this problem. I mean, I think part of it, as you've suggested, has to be really re-looking at how we adjust our expectations to deal with the realities of a world where most of the people, even many of the poor in this country, are considered wealthy by world, by global standard.
Actually, world inequality is not getting worse. It's getting worse in the first world, in the developed world, and especially in America, and especially in the militarized world. It's the new feudalism. But for instance, Brazil, the Gini coefficient in Brazil has moved down from a 6 to a 5, while in America it's gone up from a 3 to a 5. So we're now as bad as, or the same as Brazil. We have become a third world country in our income inequality. The new feudalism, this is what happens when you have rampant militarism. Without the kind of Cold War budget we've had since World War II, if we'd had the rest of the world's share of military spending, we'd all have $600,000 incomes today, $300 an hour. That's how much we've given up. And when you look at the income inequality in the Spirit Level book, that excellent work where they looked at those 22 nations, industrialized nations, and they looked at about 21 factors or so or more, at least on my spreadsheet, and they have even more in the book. The correlations with military spending are much stronger on the key variables than they are with income inequality. And I would say that this is the collapse of empire, and it has become corrupt, like the Middle Ages, where you had rampant militarism, you had the lords and the serfs, the lords protecting the serfs behind moats and castles, and you couldn't travel without an armed guard safely. That's the Middle Ages, and you have the ascendancy of the church and a decline of science. And what political party does that remind you of? But you know, it's America, though. This isn't the America that I grew up in. We've become a different country. For a generation after World War II, we managed to hold on, and that's, you saw that in the productivity statistics. But since Reagan, it's Katie bar the door, and he wouldn't get through a Republican primary these days. He's such a flaming liberal.
Okay, let's take a couple more.
Okay, so I can just ask my question. Yep. I have a big booming voice. So one is somewhat of a malformed question, and then I have a comment.
Okay, but here's Joe Elder with the mic. So I'm curious for the panel. Charlie has touched on it a little bit in terms of the conception side, or the consumption side of this question that we're talking about here. If we're talking about productivity and economic growth, I'm a little curious whether or not we know what kind of jobs and what kind of industries are actually growing here. Because in order for firms to continue to be profitable, there has to be some sort of consumption. And what Charlie is getting at in my mind is that as we see our income inequality grow, and the vast majority of the iceberg, which is like the working classes of the United States, are down below the water, and you can only see that little tippity top. If we are becoming increasingly unable to consume what I imagine are some of which are goods, but some of them are services, and Lord knows what financial mechanisms in the sky that actually make money out of thin air, then who is actually doing the consuming, or what is actually gobbling up that that excess or that that capital? And in order to help us as an audience understand that. And then the second is just a comment, which is, since everybody has shared their favorite sayings, but I think one of the sayings here tonight that I think is really applicable is one that John Steinbeck said, which was socialism would have fail to be appealing to the working classes because so many of them believe themselves to be temporarily embarrassed millionaires. And I think that is really, really illustrative in terms of the way in which working people today who don't see these things in the same way that maybe progressives do, who do believe in the Horatio Alger myth, who do sincerely hold to the American dream. This is, in fact, the way in which they see themselves and the way in which they want to see the United States, and so therefore don't want to face the music. Thank you.
Mark.
Let me just remember, that's a great question. And since, you know, maybe we'll start a trend now of people coming up with their sayings. I'm thinking of Cormac McCarthy's No Country for Old Men, where his character says, "It's the tide, the dismal tide. It ain't just the one thing." And I think we're hearing that from everybody's comments. But, you know, on your basic point, you know, has anybody heard of the concept plutonomy?
Absolutely.
Right. Citigroup, a wonderful company.
Wow.
Had something to do with the crash, I think. A number of economists at Citigroup wrote a memo in 2008 and revised it in 2009. It's now been pulled from circulation because it was so controversial, but basically making a detailed analysis, and I don't want to get all conspiratorial here, but sort of to the power elite, that, you know, we need to rethink our economic model, this consumption-based model, this sort of neo-Keynesian notion that somehow the economy is going to work with 80% or 70% or so based on, you know, this little broad middle class, that we can, in fact, have a profitable economy for our people by essentially having companies developed that specialize in providing products for the consumption of the plutocrats, hence plutonomy. And so that you've got to obviously find a, and so some of the work that will evolve for the rest of the economy will be essentially in those service occupations serving the plutocrats in this plutonomic system. And the hypothesis in this memo, the kind of scenario, was that, well, we've, you know, not, maybe not in perpetuity, but that there's a pretty good run still left in capitalism concentrating money in the hands of the group that the Citigroup economists were writing for, with this kind of plutonomic model. You know, how long can that run? I mean, it's running on a certain level kind of now. People are obviously unemployed. The stock market is booming. Plutocrats are obviously getting, you know, more and more income. There obviously is consumption around that. At a certain point, those with a Keynesian background say that can't be sustained. But, you know, then to bring in issues of militarism and the like, I mean, at what point can it be sustained by a kind of a different kind of political / cultural / economic model? So I think that's part of it. But, yeah, understand that I think Michael Spence's data on this, like 98% of all of the jobs that have been created in the U.S. have been essentially in the non-traded sector, in essentially service-providing sector.
Well, one of the things that was part of that memo, too, is sort of the underlying premise is that we really don't live in a democracy anymore.
Right, but that's the political,
and,
cultural
side of it. You know, the candor of that memo was rather shocking because it really reflects, I think, the state of where we are at this point. And there are a couple other things, I think, that really sort of jumped out at me in terms of defining part of the problem. One thing I came across, 47% of the poorest 47% of people in this country have a net value of zero.
Net worth.
Because they owe often more than all the things that they possess. That didn't used to be the case not that long ago. In 1983, the average net worth, the lowest 47%, was $15,000. Still not a lot. But right now, it's underwater. A single Hispanic or black woman in this country, for every dollar of assets she owns, anyone in the top Forbes 400 has over $40 million for every dollar of net worth. Over 40 million to one. How do we live with ourselves in that kind of society that would tolerate that kind of inequity?
Yes.
just to bring another entity into the picture, one that Buzz and Kay Davis have done an incredible research and advocacy work about, that's pensions. And let me tell a story about pensions, okay? I do my job. I get this pension. Money gets accumulated. Supposedly, that money is invested in those corporations. So when those corporations do really well, and maybe my pay isn't climbing that much, then I should be happy, though, because I'll be getting that money eventually in that pension because those monies are being invested in all that. Those are the stories, again, we're I love the story theme, the narrative theme, that we're being told. Now, that brings in the whole system of pension robbing that's been and pension draining that's been the mechanism that's been developing recently and all that. And that's another set of conferences and all that. I don't mean to bring that up, but I do mean to bring up the narrative that keeps this system in place, the thing that's stopping revolution from happening, because there's enough of us who have these pensions who believe that these corporate profits are a very good thing and that our, you know, people who run our pensions should be, you know, looking out for those Walmarts because that company is going to have a good return and all of that. Again, supporting these really badly run companies who have the good stock market returns and thus supporting these systems. I just want to tell you that we're not complete buffoons here, those of us who aren't openly rebelling.
There's a major problem in that a growing number of people have no prospect of having a pension. And many of the people who had pensions have seen the value of those pensions decline to the point where they no longer have the prospect for a reasonable retirement. And
Reagan in 1986. He screwed up.
When do we get to talk about the good part here?
In about 2 minutes.
Buzz Davis from Stoughton. When we look at all of this and we say, okay, what do we want to do about it? I think that we have to do a couple things. But before I say anything we have to do, I'll say what is going to happen. That's good. The baby boomers who are retiring are the best educated people we've ever had in the United States. All right? Most of them do not have pensions. Some of them, a good slug of them, have 401ks with maybe $100,000, $200,000 in the 401k pension. So all they're going to live on is Social Security, almost zero in savings, and they're going to run down that 401k real fast. And the ones that don't have 401ks are going to be angry real fast. So the ones that have no pension are going to be angry pretty fast when they retire. And the ones that have 401ks and think they're hot shots will be angry a little later. So what we will have is the best educated people in our history.
And they'll all be
really
pissed off.
Maybe. About what has happened. Okay? That doesn't mean they're going to be able to understand what to do about it. But at least they will be really, really angry. And so that's one big factor that's coming. In the late 30s or in the early 30s with the Depression, you had lots of people who were angry and not many people figuring out what to do. The executives, CEOs did not know what to do about it. FDR fumbled around with a bunch of smart people. They began to do some things about it, not enough, but anyway, they began to do some things about the Depression and capitalism run wild. Well, today we have capitalism run wild again, but now we're a little smarter. We know what those son of a bitches have to be regulated. We're not regulating them, but we know they have to be regulated. So when we look at what we should be doing today, for many of us in this room, we've spent our lives chasing after doing good things and forcing these bad players to play nicely. And we've failed one after another. We have failed in almost everything we have done. And what we have to do is go after the military, industrial, politician complex, which is run by the one percenters. They make money, billions of dollars, whether we lose wars or whether we win wars. And now they're in the bag of having wars forever and having some of us folks dumb enough to join them. But anyway, we have to impeach those people, throw them out of office, and start a new way of thinking with new politicians who will listen to us. When we have Baldwin and Pocan and the rest of the people who are about as best as they can come today, and we go in and meet with them, and we talk with them on tough topics, and they say, well, thank you very much, blah, 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 blah. And they say, well, he's gone, and he can't do anything to me. Because I pay attention to the rich.
Buzz, that's an excellent segue into the last segment of our program here, and that is, where do we go from here? And let me ask, first of all, the panelists to give a one or two sentence only answer to that question, and then once again we'll throw it out to the audience for your perceptions of where do we go from here, which Buzz has very nicely introduced. Mark, you want to start?
Yeah, I mean...
That's one sentence.
I mean, that's really short. I'm tempted to say, after all of these comments, and we've take pitchforks and head to the streets is where we go from here. But and what someone going to say sounds almost tame by what sort of everybody else has been pointing out. But I think there are things we can do with political mobilization, and I grant that there are lots of things impeding that mobilization, and I don't dismiss any of these, but just in terms of, I think there is a real thing called the economy. I think the economy can be made to work. I think there are things we can do, like investing in infrastructure, like realigning tax policy to discourage offshoring, like getting trade policies in place that don't hemorrhage jobs. So those are just kind of three general areas of things that we can do, and that doesn't even get to sort of things that we can actually do to somehow make things a little better, locally, like living wage ordinances and fair practices and those sorts of things. I think there are obviously some ways that we can go, and it will require obviously some dramatic political changes. And I wish I had a magic wand, but.
Where do we go from here?
Yep.
The bar.
With the pitchforks.
With the pitchforks. I guess, I'm psyched about the pissed off baby boomers. I hope it's true. And in fact, I think one of the things Wisconsin we learned in the last couple of years is that people do still sometimes have a capacity to say no. And I think sometimes we have so rarely experienced the no. Someone messes with a pension in India and a lot of people hit the street. Or look at Bangladesh, right? Hundreds of garment workers out on the streets burning their boss's building. Not always, but a little bit. That is bold. That is a bold no from a desperate people. We don't do that. We, kind of look up and say, damn, and then...
Grumble, grumble.
Play with our phones. So you said two sentences and I've said 400 already. I think we have to find the way to get to where people are pissed off and to get the no's, get more no going in this society and get some yeses about the positive things we can do, but that is about taking power and being mad enough to notice that you want to.
Now you get your
two sentences. My dad was fond of saying, every dollar you spend is a vote. Vote for some kind of economic system, some kind of future. And I think we have still some power that is often not recognized or exercised to change the kind of economy, the kind of country we live in by becoming better informed and more conscientious consumers, by supporting the kind of businesses that support the community, that pay their employees well, that don't pollute the environment, pay their taxes. We can make it, because those consumer dollars still represent a huge, huge proportion of the economy. And in fact, there's a lot of discussion, who are the job creators? I got to tell you, the consumers are really the job creators. No, jobs don't get created without a demand. And demand comes when people have got some money in their pocket to spend. And if they can spend those dollars in an intelligent, thoughtful way, it can change, it can revolutionize the way in which this country and the way in which our economy functions.
Yes.
That was
Joe,
more than
you decide.
I rely on personal care attendants that are hired by an agency. They don't get benefits. They don't get sick time. They don't get vacation time. They get measly hours. They get paid for 1 hour. It may take them an hour to get there by bus. They don't have a lot of income. So where do they shop? They shop at Walmart, where they can get the cheapest prices. Yeah. So how do we change? It's a vicious cycle. We can't tell them to go to other stores that they can't afford. They're not going to do that. And they don't, some of them don't have the political awareness that they're, you know, by patronizing Walmart, they're perpetuating the problem. Because mm-hmm. they're just trying to get by on a day-to-day basis.
But let me, you know, yes, absolutely. But let me point out that this is the one place where, you know, the wage setting structure we have in the private home care industry is established by policy. It isn't markets that are making that. That's Medicare, Medicaid, and other state, you know, their federal funds that come into the state and get spent by the counties. And they have a choice about the wage standards they put on those. We all do. That's a public policy choice. And we have chosen consistently to make those the lowest wage jobs. These are healthcare workers who, you know, provide health care and cannot get health insurance. Maybe that'll change tomorrow. No, Tuesday, Monday, whatever. So I think that's a place where the policy change needs to happen about job quality, and it will cost money, and it's something that, you know, the state doesn't want.
We're already spending too much on Medicaid and Medicare. Realistically, they're not going to increase the amount of money spent for personal care workers. I mean, I don't see that happening.
But again, that's a question of political power,
right,
and class power.
Right, and it's a question of rules, right? The economy is not some organic entity that sort of goes along by itself. I mean, we make the rules of the economy. And in fact, with a higher minimum wage, with even living wage ordinances and the like, it's a hard sector, I guess, to unionize. Yes, I understand it's not happening, but it seems to me that's what's got to happen for improvement in conditions rather than persuading low-income people to boycott Walmart. I mean, I think that kind of strategy, in all due respect, is not necessarily going to succeed in the long run. We can keep Walmart out of certain communities. There can be some kind of mobilization in various places. But I think long run, in the same way that organization from the 50s on and raising the minimum wage at various points established a higher floor for workers across the board, that will be the way that sector will be benefited as well.
Well, one of the things that was interesting about the memo that Mark referred to, written by Citigroup, the one threat that they saw to Platonomy was that people might wake up and decide that this wasn't fair and demand a fair share of the productivity that has produced this wealth. Well, the extremes are so incredible right now. In 2009, the top 25 hedge fund managers took home $25.3 billion, which is equivalent to the total salary and fringe of 338,041 teachers in Wisconsin with a 15 years average experience. That would fund all of the teachers in 5 states.
I have a proposal.
And also, by the way, home health care workers and home daycare workers did have the right to organize and had organized under executive order by Governor Doyle. And their right to have a union was taken away as a result of Act 10 from Governor Walker. So they had a chance to be able to bargain and improve their condition, their wages, and all the things that you were pointing out. But then politically, they lost that.
And there are some other models. In Marshfield, there is a worker-owned cooperative of home health care providers. They have about 130 of them that organizes a cooperative and provide in-home health care, and they basically own their own business. And they have been growing and providing excellent care and have decent wages and decent benefits. So I think that's another model I think that we could look to in terms of changing the dynamics in terms of...
Right, and to follow up on Buzz's point, I mean, look at all the additional leverage they're going to have in the upcoming years when all of us retired baby boomers are relying on this labor force, and all of a sudden being exploited, the realization says, wait a second, what if we go on strike and all those wealthy, well, some wealthy, but educated and needy retired baby boomers are going to need us. They'd be maybe the same people who are out there yelling at Tea Party rallies for, you know, keep your government hands off my Medicare or something. Like, you know, I want my home health care worker to be paid a living wage. I mean, maybe that's, oh, I mean, political breakthroughs come in kind of mysterious ways. And so maybe that's one way that somehow, you know, some kind of mobilization could occur.
Joe?
I think many of us felt that the couple of decades after the Second World War were not perfect, but a lot better than things are now. And I think really that was the legacy of the New Deal. Labor legislation, Social Security, a lot of other things were still here. And so how did we get that? We want to create change. We got the New Deal, of course, from the Great Depression. What we've learned now is that a great recession is not enough. And I'm sorry to be pessimistic, but I think it will take more than the Great Depression to change the politics of this country, and that the best we can do is to be thinking about things that might work if something like that happened and we had a chance to have some influence in what comes next. Okay, so much for the big picture. A little thing. Recently, I heard the AFL-CIO convention had adopted a new strategy for labor that instead of the only focus, I may say the wrong thing here, but that realizing that there's a limit to the progress they'll make by creating unions and trying to get other workers who are not in unions still might be organized in some way so as to have an influence on things. I've now told you all I know about that, but I hope somebody else here might know what happened there and be able to say whether something was put in place there that might make a difference.
It's just the beginning, but very quickly, Laura had been talking about day laborers and basically, you know, hanging out on a corner and getting picked up by contractors. There have been efforts going back about 5 or 6 years to organize them and have them be associated with AFL-CIO. Working America is sort of an associate member program. Now includes about 3 million workers who are they don't have union contracts, but they are associate members of the AFL-CIO itself. Working America. It's a program that has more potential than it has reality at this point, even though it's been going about 6-7 years. And there's also, at the same time, an attempt to reach out to allied groups and form much stronger coalitions. For example, the Student Labor Action Coalition here on campus just affiliated with the AFL-CIO a couple days ago, this last week. And similar kinds of organizations, including environmental groups and so forth, now have an opportunity to have a much closer working relationship with the AFL-CIO. And it's going to take time. It's going to take a lot of compromise, a lot of innovation in order to make that work. But it's a matter of organizing power. And that's what we have to keep in mind, that it's not simply bargaining the next contract. What we have to look at is the working class in the larger perspective, a larger definition of the working class, and organizing that working class in order to improve the well-being of the entire country.
In the past few weeks, we've seen a number of programs in the media and newspaper stories about the issue of inequality. I think we're at the beginning of a longer-term discussion. We'll have to see if that translates into organization and that can actually address this issue in a political way. But there were two programs this week on public radio that interviewed Robert Reich, the former labor secretary, about a new film that he's called Inequality for All, in which he is featured. And that was supposed to be released this week. It's not in Madison yet, but it should be coming here. And a chance to learn more and also to invite your friends and continue the discussion.
I would just mention that they have a website for Inequality for All, and they're looking for people who want to host parties or sort of viewing parties to air the video. I think this, as it was suggested, is part of a discussion that's going to be growing.
I've got a four-point plan, quickly.
Arm the peasants. Go
back to 70% for the rich, settle for 50% as a political deal, tax rate, $15 an hour minimum wage, break up the big banks. They've gone from 6% of corporate income to 30% of corporate income, and they have unfair competition to the small banks, which will loan to the small businesses that create real jobs, and cut the military 3% of GNP back to the world standard of 2% of GNP instead of 5%, and that 3% will be just like the 90s, produce the same kind of boom that we saw under Clinton when it went from Reagan to Clinton, 3% down on military and doubled the economic growth rate.
Sold. I'll sign right up. There you go.
Okay. Let's take two more questions, and then we will wrap this up and march out of here with pitchforks.
To the bar.
To the bar.
First, a comment. Hitler exploited anger very well. I think anger's to hope that the best we can do in a democracy is to stimulate anger, I think, is a pretty pathetic expectation. Two stories, again, I've talked about stories. One story we can say is we have to get big money out of politics. Here's another way we can look at that. We have to convince our neighbors to become people, voters who are not for sale. Those are not the same things. There's a lot of big money spent on politics, and there are a lot of people who don't pay any attention to it. I mean, there's a lot spent on advertising on television. I don't watch TV. It doesn't affect me at all. I don't even know most of what's going on. And to me, this also goes to what is our hope, what is our ambition for a democracy. To me, if we think that the people, the masses out there, are too stupid and too easily manipulated, that we have to make sure that not too much money is spent to get their attention span, we should just get over saying we believe in democracy. Because we don't trust the masses to vote right. You know, if the Koch brothers and the like come into Wisconsin and spend enough money, the masses out there, the minority of them, vote for Scott Walker, and we think that's wrong. So at root, it's not a fun thing to think about, but we really don't trust people. If we really don't want to trust people, then we should stop pretending we believe in democracy.
One of the things that Jefferson said is a well-informed citizenry is essential to the preservation of a republic. And I think that's really the key. I mean, money shouldn't be the big factor that it is, but if we don't have a lot of money to get the word out to make people well-informed and educated about what's going on, we need to then take the time to talk with each other. And frankly, that's more effective than all the ads combined. But it's going to require some effort on our part to talk to friends, to neighbors. Everybody here has got networks, email lists, you know, coworkers, friends, relatives. We need to be making a conscious effort to spend far more time talking to people about what's going on in this country. The irony is that And I actually ended up running for the assembly last year in a primary way, made a commitment not to raise or spend more than $1,000. So I'm not in the assembly, as you might know.
I was going to say, congratulations on your victory, Charlie.
But there were some really valuable things that came out. The thing that I was most impressed by, when people want to feel listened to. And people are paying far more attention to what's going on than I thought they were. And I think that creates an opportunity to start those conversations, to start the discussion one-on-one with friends and neighbors and people with whom we interact to make the kind of changes. Basically, across the board, most people want the same thing. They want good jobs, good schools, affordable health care, clean environment, safe communities, and fair taxes. You won't get any argument from that, even from Republicans in most part. So if you start with that assumption that we want a lot of the same things, the real focus has to be on how do we get there and what works. And the reality is things like trickle-down have not worked very well. And that's where we need to start, I think, in terms of having those conversations and starting to begin to build not a political party, but a movement that can inform and overpower the forces that are trying to manipulate our economy and our country.
Good sum up. Let's give a good hand to our panel. Mark, Laura, Charlie. And now give yourselves a round of applause. You've been a great audience, and the questions and comments have been terrific.
Woo!
Thank you.
There's the state of working Wisconsin's out there, which is really good bedtime reading or a gift, perhaps a hostess gift for a dinner you're going to tomorrow night. There's also a sign-up list for getting cash with email.
Fabulous. Okay, thank you all.
I also have a very limited number of a brochure. It's sort of a little bit tongue-in-cheek. I'm sure everyone's heard of It's the Economy Stupid. Well, this is It's the Stupid Economy, an Idiot's Guide to Jobs, Full Employment, and Prosperity. So.